So for our second main topic, I wanted to look at a character that the Warfare Queen, and look at some of the bad raps that Warfare actually gets, you know. And for our, you know, so I wanted to look at this character because, you know, if you know what the Warfare Queen is, or you don't know, it's the woman who drives a luxury vehicle. She wears designer clothes, all while being on a welfare recipient. In other words, she is ghetto fabulous. But I wanted to know whether this stereotype originates.
So the caricature is of a black woman as being a welfare queen. So it's a caricature, meaning that it's not actually real. You know,
Right,
there's the
exactly.
example of Linda Taylor, who was a con artist, but there aren't several Linda Taylors around here. You
Exactly.
know, like I think you did mention this, but most welfare recipients, first of all, there's been so many changes to welfare, right? Over the years, politics have used that caricature to make policy changes to make it even harder to access welfare or to receive real assistance through welfare. But those people who are receiving public assistance generally are white. Not to say that black people don't use it, but if you look at the percentages, white people are using it more, which makes sense because we're in a country that has majority white people.
Welcome to episode 14 of Breaking It Down with DJ and Courtney. Yes, we are back with another episode.
Episode 14.
Yes, we are one episode away from our season finale.
The penultimate episode.
So I'm so glad that you joined us again or for the first time. So please be sure to subscribe. There are so many ways to reach out and touch us. So you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and now LinkedIn. So be sure to subscribe, follow, like, comment, and share. And don't be afraid to leave us a review.
That's
As a matter of
right.
fact, do it right now. Do it, do it.
Do
Do it right now. Put the show on pause and just do it right now and come back. So we like to start each episode with a little segment called What's Still Cooking? It gives Courtney and me a chance to highlight things that we may have watched, saw, experienced, read over the last week that still may be lingering on our minds. So what's still cooking for me? Supermodel Naomi Campbell welcomed her first child this week.
Wow. Mommy
Yes.
Naomi or Mother Dearest?
That's a good question. Hopefully this baby softens her so she's not throwing cell phones at chauffeurs and assistants. So the vibrant 50
congratulations
year
to her.
congratulations to her. The vibrant 50-year-old announced the news Tuesday via her Instagram account. The post revealed that tiny little feet of an infant cupped by Naomi's well-manicured hand. The caption read, "A beautiful little blessing has chosen me to be a mother. So honored to have this gentle soul in my life. There are no words to describe the lifelong bond that I now share with you, my angel. There is no greater love." Yeah,
How sweet.
so I think that's so sweet. So, however, fans were quickly to start inquiring who her baby daddy
That's none of
is.
our business. That is none of our business.
Their business is our business.
No, last time I checked, minding the business is free.
Are they're also wondering if she used a sperm donor?
Again, none of our business.
Yeah, so there hasn't been any mention about who the father is, but however, I do suspect that he's European with a few millions in his bank account.
Probably.
Yeah, Naomi's known for dating very powerful businessmen, and she's dated a Italian businessman, a Russian millionaire, and she's also been known to be dating, lastly, a member from the One Direction band, Liam Payne. So she stays quite busy, you know?
DJ.
But she don't. But what I mean by that is she's a smart businesswoman. Now, one thing I say, she's very talented, very beautiful, but she's a smart businesswoman. So okay. I have a lot of respect for her. And bad news for the comedy world. This week, legendary comedian Paul Mooney died in Oakland, California. Mm-hmm. On Wednesday of a heart attack, Mooney has collaborated and inspired many comedic giants like Richard Pryor, Red Fox, Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock, Eddie Murphy, and many other Hollywood household names in comedy. Mooney has written for television, for movies like The Chappelle Show, In Living Color. I didn't realize he wrote for Good Times. Wow. My favorite movies, Bustin' Loose, that old movie back in the 80s, Hollywood Shuffle. In 90s, it was Bamboozled, amongst others that he's collaborated with other comedic giants. He is truly the godfather of comedy and will be missed.
He definitely will be missed. I love Paul Mooney. I thought that his humor was very intelligent, mm-hmm. Witty, and a little dry, kind of like mm-hmm. my wine, mm-hmm. how I like my wine. Like his comedy was really brilliant. So condolences to his family and he's gonna be missed.
Yeah, I enjoyed his comedy as well. And one thing he did do, he always picked on everybody, every mm-hmm. race. But he definitely always gave us things to think about from a very polarizing way, you know. So I am wishing his family well too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's still cooking for me is Emmy Award winning actor Billy Porter, who portrays HIV positive character Pray Tell on Pose, revealed last week that he is HIV positive. He says he was diagnosed 14 years ago in 2007 and has lived in shame with the diagnosis for many years. He's quoted saying, "The shame of that time, compounded with the shame that had already accumulated in my life, silenced me. And I have lived with that shame and silence for 14 years. HIV positive, where I come from, growing up in the Pentecostal church with a very religious family, is God's punishment." Mm. What I didn't realize is that he's an Oscar away from an EGOT, and he had kept the secret even from his mother. Wow. And when he realized that even though she's aging, she's still going to be around, she did share with her this year that secret, and she told him that she loves him no matter what. So I was really proud to hear that, and I'm just really glad that he can let go of the shame, because it's not needed. You know?
It's so true, and getting that acceptance from your family, It's a great feeling to get that from them. So I'm happy for him.
Yes, I am happy for him. And, you know, I love him. I didn't get to see him on Broadway in Kinky Boots. Mm. But I love him on Pose. And mm-hmm. I love his fashion sense and the way that he pushes the envelope. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to hear that he gets to live his life more fully now.
Yeah, years ago, he had a single out called... Love is on the Way. It was from a movie, The First Wives Club, back in the day, I think in the 90s. And this song, I have it on my playlist. Anytime I feel down, I listen to this song and it lifts me up. And it's called, again, Love is on the Way. So have a chance, listen to the song. It will blow your mind. His voice is amazing.
I will listen to it. Maybe that's the song that got him the Grammy. So I'll definitely check that out.
I would not doubt that.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into the show.
Yeah.
Moving into our first topic, it seems like we have some sort of symbiotic relationship with the Red Table Talk. We are inspired by them, and it looks like they may also be inspired by us. Mm-hmm. On their episode 2 weeks ago, they discussed the invisible Black woman. They had activist Tamika Mallory, who was involved with the planning of the historic women's movement, the Women's March, on, along with another Black woman, a writer, professor, and MacArthur genius, Tressie McMillan Cottom, who shared her traumatic emergency room visit. Their stories brought up some of the issues that we were talking about on episode 9, about how Black feminist theology calls out the controlling images used against Black women to justify their oppression and mistreatment. Additionally, when you shared the story about your friend's treatment by her foot surgeon in episode 11, and my own experience that same week at the oral surgeon, prompted me to want us to discuss this further.
Yes. So I do have a story about the invisible woman. And so the story that I have about my sister, God bless her. I love my sister so much. She went to the hospital to have my nephew, to give birth to my nephew. And what happened was, my nephew ended up getting home before she did. Mm. The reason why is because after she had him, she had many complications, and they kept asking her. They said, how on the scale of 1 to 10, how much pain are you in?
Right.
And mind you, she couldn't even walk to the bathroom. She was in that much pain. Wow. Okay. So she would say, a 7 or an 8, when it was really, a 20, so it was off the scale. So all in all, we had to convince her to leave this hospital and go to a different hospital because she just wasn't getting the treatment that she needed. They saw that she was in pain. They knew why she kept saying that she was at a 7 or an 8 when she was really could see that she was beyond that. So we took her to the second hospital, and the doctor said to her immediately that if you would have stayed another day in that hospital, you would have died of infection.
Wow.
They pulled out hand-sized blobs of blood clots from her wound, which he actually stapled the wounds instead of, which you don't even do any longer, which is, antiquated. And so thank God that she finally left that hospital because she was an invisible woman. They were not tending her to her and her needs. Mm-hmm. So what I believe is that healthcare providers, those doctors, those nurses believe that she had a higher tolerance for pain because she was a Black woman.
Mm, that is that's a problem, that's a really big problem. One, about the whole invisible part, but that myth that Black women don't experience pain or Black people have a higher tolerance for pain, and that's actually been proven wrong. A 2016 University of Virginia study showed that white medical students and residents believed inaccurate differences about Blacks and whites. Some include that Blacks have less sensitive nerve endings than whites, or wow, that Black people's blood coagulates more quickly. Moreover, those who held those false beliefs often rated Black patients' pain as lower than that of white patients and made less appropriate recommendations about how they should be treated. So that whole notion of Black people being able to tolerate pain and the way that your sister was treated and the way that your friend was treated by her oral surgeon, just like dismissing her concerns and her wishes, which she stated, which were written down. So, someone will say, oh, that was just a mistake. But because she's a Black woman and because there's this history of Black women being ignored, I can't disassociate those two things. And then my own experience, I was recently at the oral surgeon. At the initial surgery, everything went fine, but he did one small mistake. So when it was time to do the follow-up, everything didn't go as normally planned. It was normally was planned. And then 3 months later at the follow-up to move to from the temporary crown to the permanent crown, because of the mistake he made, my gums healed around the crown in a certain way. So when he removed it, the screw that he put in had come out, right? But before he starts to clear my gums to access the implant, because I had dental implants put in, he didn't offer me any anesthesia. So I'm verbally expressing that I'm in pain. Oh, we should, do some anesthesia. Like, hell yeah. When I left the appointment, I was grateful that I've had a background working as a community health worker where I've had to coach Black people specifically, because I worked with Black poor people and specific Medicaid recipients on advocating for their needs in the healthcare setting. So I was able to advocate for my needs in that moment.
So how do you How do you think is the best way, or how would you coach a woman to speak up at the doctor's office?
Yeah. So a lot of my work when I was doing that type of work was revolving around education, strategies, mm-hmm. and affirmation. So I would educate. So the program that I was working for was about educating Medicaid recipients that either had hypertension, diabetes, or asthma. So educating my patients on what their symptoms were, what their illnesses were, what things that they should be looking for to care for themselves so that they knew that if they were experiencing something, they should go to the doctor. Or mm-hmm. if, you know, what's normal, what's not normal, so that they would know that, right? And right. then setting up the framework, because there's this huge power dynamic that occurs. And I think this might would have been happening with your sister, mm-hmm. Where especially, I don't know if your sister, what your sister's economic background is, but especially if you're poor in this country, and then if you're Black, there's this notion, because all of the systems that cater to poor people have this thing where we're criminalizing them and we want them to fall in line, right? So there's this notion that you are breaking the rules for being poor. So when you walk into a doctor's office, that power dynamic is in play, where the doctor's in charge and you have to follow their rules and whatever they say is right. But the actual dynamic in a true healthcare system is you're the coach. So mm-hmm. I would set up this dynamic that you're the head coach, the doctor's a player on the team. You know your body. So once right. you have the education on how the body should be responding, like what mm-hmm. health actually feels like, and you know what you're experiencing, you are the one that calls the shots when you go into the doctor's office. And there'd be times I would accompany these clients to their appointments. The doctors were not happy to see me there.
Oh, wow. Especially if they'd be like, oh, we know her.
Right. They weren't happy because I would make their jobs harder because, you know, it's about... They couldn't just throw a prescription at someone, you know? Mm-hmm, it's like, mm-hmm. do I need this prescription? Is there something else that I can do? What are the side effects of this medication? I was helping my clients be empowered about their health in a way that the system, especially for poor people, especially for Black women, it's not wanting them to show up in that way, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then the last thing, it's really ironic that we're talking about this now because I just had a Facebook memory from my time working this position where the agency that I was working with or the organization that I was working with realized that this problem was happening, that people were, especially poor people, were showing up in doctor's office feeling disempowered. So we created affirmation cards, and me being the graphic designer for the organization, I designed the cards. Mm-hmm. And it was focusing around affirmations about I am worthy. So we gave them affirmations to feel empowered to show up to their appointments, to run the show, to be the coach. So, you know, the coaching that I did really helped them to confront and challenge the controlling images that were in play in those situations.
I know we discussed in a previous episode about Patricia Hill Collins mm-hmm. and the controlling images and how they're played. And one thing that you did, you taught me and educated me on was these different controlling images, which I knew existed, but I didn't know that someone actually had categorized them. Mm-hmm. And that, like you said earlier about the strong Black woman, she can tolerate the pain, she can put up with it. And I believe that mentality, some Black women do have, like my sister, she had that mentality. She was telling them she was at a 7 when she was really at a 20.
Yeah, and some Black women have internalized it.
Right, and I bet if she was sitting in an emergency room and she saw a white woman there who was in pain, probably less pain than she was, she would allow her to go first because she would feel as though, well, she needs it and she's, you know, she's the weak white woman or a woman who is more fragile. So she can go ahead on and I can see it because I can bear this pain more than she can. And I think that has been internalized by Black women, that they can put up with more pain than others when they could be in 10 times more pain than the other person who is a different race.
Yeah. Well, we need to move on into the next topic. So what's your breakdown?
So my breakdown is that Black women are strong and they are resilient and they are vulnerable and more vulnerable than they know. And I'm just glad that you're out there coaching them and teaching them that how to sort of mitigate the conversation with your doctor. I'm glad that somebody's out there, maybe someone heard this conversation that we're having and decide to take on that role as well, to accompany them to a doctor's appointment to say, hey, you need to be asking these questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 I would say that, I would say that we need to move away from the Black woman is strong. I do. I think we need to move away from the Black woman is resilient. Those are things that we need to say. We know they're true. The mm-hmm. Black woman is worthy. The Black woman needs to be protected. Like you said, she is vulnerable, and she has been invisible. And I would say to all the Black women who may have internalized that message that we need to be strong, and that because there's so much that lays on our shoulders, that it is safe for us to rest. Mm. It is. It is safe for us to rest. It is a radical act of resistance to prioritize our self-care, but it is necessary. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of things that was said on the Red Table Talk. I behoove, you know, not for everyone to listen to our shows, but that episode on the Invisible Black Woman, a strategy that was given is that in terms of Black women in healthcare, instead of allowing that power dynamic of the doctor being, you know, powerful or whatever, see the doctor as a service provider. If the doctor was the person that was doing your hair and they messed up, you would let them know. So, you know, like we get to remove the doctor from that pedestal and recognize that we are the one that has the most knowledge about our own health, and that mm-hmm. we can advocate for ourselves. And in every space, it is okay. And if we collectively do it, the world will shift by saying no and prioritizing ourselves. To my sisters, that is my call and my prayer for myself and for you, that we put ourselves first, and that we claim our visibility by putting our foots down. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Our feet down.
Our feet.
All right.
So for our segment, Make You Laugh, I found the story about this week, a woman on Monday, a 20-year-old Florida woman who allegedly went to a Miami, I don't know, I'm saying allegedly before because she did it, but you know, but went to a Miami high school dressed as a student and to promote her Instagram account. What? Yeah, she was later arrested. So Audrey Nicole Francis Queenie was so desperate to be followed and liked on Instagram, she pretended to be a student while trespassing on a Miami high school. Wait. So, she was at the school, she was handing out flyers. So as she was handing out flyers with her Instagram account name there, saying, hey, please follow me, please like my account, the security officer asked her, you know, why are you handing these flyers out? She said, I'm a student. Had a backpack on, she was carrying a skateboard, and she was recording interactions with her smartphone.
But wait. What good are the followers? I don't understand.
Well, you know, she wants the followers on Instagram. She wants people to start liking her on Instagram. And she felt like she'd go to the school where the followers are. And that was the local high school. Oh, my gosh. So the security officer told the security officer, once another security officer saw her, she said, I'm just looking for a registration office. And continue on to pass out her pre-printed flyers. And the principal wanted to track her down, but she decided to sort of leave from a side door from the school. And the police were able to find her pretty quickly. They just went to her Instagram account. Exactly.
Oh my gosh.
And arrested her. She faces charges of burglary, interference with an educational institution, and resisting an officer.
She's going to a college campus. Aren't there colleges in Florida?
It's different ways to do that without going to a high school and bothering high school students.
Wow. World's dumbest criminal.
Yeah, that was pretty stupid. So for our second main topic, I wanted to look at a character that the Wayfair Queen, and look at some of the bad raps that Wayfair actually gets, you know. And for our, you know, so I wanted to look at this character because, you know, if you know what the Wayfair Queen is, or you don't know, it's the woman who drives a luxury vehicle. She wears designer clothes, all while being on a welfare recipient. In other words, she is ghetto fabulous. But I wanted to know where did this stereotype originate. So have you ever, well, of course you heard of the welfare queen before, absolutely, right? You know, and that, and I want, and when you start researching it and start looking at the history behind the Wayfair Queen, you know, it goes back to Ronald Reagan, our 40th president. Say it again.
How surprising.
You know, I like the quote that you said in a previous episode, everything is goes back to racism. Everything.
It does. In this country, at least.
So during his presidential campaign, Reagan used the Wayfair Queen character as a pun to depict how liberal policies on Wayfair had gone wrong. So he wanted to use that as a way to sort of push his agenda. And during his campaign, his rhetoric described a black woman who owns several security cards, several social security cards, a little, so mooches on benefits from her fake dead husbands, collects welfare payments under 80 counterfeit names while getting food stamps. The character was built on fiction, but there was some truth behind it, even though he was out to demonize welfare as a whole. So have you ever heard of a woman called Linda Taylor?
I have not. Had not.
Well, she was a unique story. She was basically a con artist who was mixed raced. You know, she was a little bit of a racial chameleon. She could be seen as, she could dress her hair in a certain way, makeup in a certain way, where she could be looked as a white woman, a black woman, or even a Latino woman. And when she was doing her con artist work, she would sometimes appear in those different costumes as those different races.
Right.
So, but when Ronald Reagan began to sort of put this image out there, he definitely made it clear that this was a black woman, not a mixed woman. And it personified the Wayfair Queen as a black woman.
Okay.
And that stereotype is still living today for black women. Even though most people that are on welfare are actually Caucasian, are actually white. You know, it's really crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a little background on Linda Taylor. So the Chicago Tribune identified her in 1874, mind you. Okay. That's a century since when he actually talked about this woman. So he went digging in the archive trying to find the story.
Yeah.
And she had been looking for some stuff and found it. So Reagan, he found the story about this woman. She was driving fancy cars, including a Cadillac. She had forged social security cards, all this stuff to mooch off of welfare benefits. And she was making $150,000 a year doing this. But yeah, and the whole purpose around this was, he wanted to just demonize welfare because him and the Republican Party was against the idea.
Yeah. That makes sense. And I mean, it's Reagan's tactics of trying to associate welfare with black women is no different than what we talked about in episode 2 with Nixon creating the war on drugs and making it seem like black people and people against the Vietnam War were, you know, hippies, and, you know, all the hippies were on pot and marijuana and all black people were on heroin. Right.
Right.
So it's no different. It's no different.
Well, I mean, no need for me to ask you, do you think this, I think I already talked about this stereotype still exists about the welfare queen being the black woman, again, the invisible woman that you mentioned earlier in our previous segment. And this way she's invisible because you're not even seeing her for who she is. She's been seen as a character, and that has been placed on her and putting a cloak on who she really is.
So the caricature is of a black woman as being a welfare queen. So right. It's a caricature, meaning that it's mm-hmm. not actually real. You know,
right,
there's
exactly.
the example of Linda Taylor, who was a con artist, but mm-hmm. there aren't several Linda Taylors around here.
Exactly.
You know, like I think you did mention this, but most welfare recipients, first of all, there's been so many changes to welfare, right?
Mm-hmm.
Over
mm-hmm.
the years, politics have used that caricature to make policy changes to make it even harder to access welfare or mm-hmm. to receive real assistance through welfare. But mm-hmm. those people who are receiving public assistance generally are white. Not to say right. that black people don't use it, but if you mm-hmm. look at the percentages, white people are using it more, which makes sense mm-hmm. because we're in a country that has majority white people.
Exactly. And black people make up 13% of our, and a lot of people don't even know this. A lot of black people don't. I have told them this, like, huh, what, 13%? I'm like, yes. So one thing that I noticed during the Obama presidency,
mm-hmm.
he was actually ridiculed and called the welfare president or the food stamp president
mm-hmm.
because he offered a lot of government programs to everyone, to corporations. He offered to Americans, black, white, and everything mm-hmm. in the middle. But he was called that because he was trying basically get us through a financial crisis when he entered the office.
Absolutely.
So that's one of the things that frustrated me so badly during his presidency, because the Republican Party tried to frame him as that.
Absolutely. And you know, it's crazy that Republicans were trying to demonize him by calling him that, right? Not acknowledging that it was a Republican president that was sending the country into that recession, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was George W. Bush that had the country going towards a recession. And, you know, it's interesting. Timothy Smeeting, who's a professor mm-hmm. of public affairs at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, and he's also the former director of that school's Institute for Research on Poverty, says that Obama did a good job in a really tough situation.
Yeah.
Poverty would have increased a lot more without what he did. So the tactic that Republicans are doing, you know, like it's Nixon and Reagan, what they're all doing, it's not unfamiliar. What they're doing is they're trying to create this buy-in from poor whites. They're trying mm. to use racism to separate poor people, right?
True.
Because if we look at, even, you know, during slavery, times of slavery or right after slavery, we can go that far back, or we don't even have to go that far back. We can look to the time when Martin Luther King was alive. Part of the reason that he was assassinated was because he moved his movement towards fighting for the rights for poor people.
Right, exactly.
He crosses the color line. And mm-hmm. and when poor people are united and they join forces with people who are oppressed because of their color, there is more political power there. But if you keep them separated, you have more of a division, and you have these poor white people who are looking at blacks as though that they're the problem and that they're a threat, when they mm-hmm. actually would benefit from the public assistance programs
right.
that they're demonizing, right?
Exactly. You know, so do you think corporate welfare under the guise of government subsidies are more palatable to the right?
You know, because, you know, it's like Republicans recognize what the system is, and businesses get a pass because they get that tax write-off,
right.
Where it's the same thing as if, you know, if I need public assistance for whatever reason, you know, mm-hmm. like businesses could mismanage their money and they get help from the government.
The bailout.
right, exactly. But if I mismanage my money, I'm wrong and I just have to tough it out. I have to figure it out.
Right, you'd pull yourself by the bootstraps, they say.
Exactly. You know? So yeah.
So one question, and because I think Biden, because he is a Caucasian, he's a white male, is a president. Mm-hmm. Do you think that he'll be able to escape that being called the food stamp president, the welfare president, because he's a white president?
I think for the first 3 years of his presidency, he will. I think the year that he's going to have to campaign, or, you know, I don't think he's going to run again, but the next Democrat is going to have to, they're probably going to be put up against, are you going to continue the Biden legacy of being the food stamps, you know, whatever. I think it depends on what the economy is going to do. Like, is there going to be a shift? Is there going to be more of a need? I mean, you know, we're moving out of COVID, and we're moving out of what almost was the biggest financial recession that we've seen in the country. Right. So I'm sure there is a need for more aid to be done. And of course, the right is going to turn on that. But I don't think it's going to be as big of a problem as it was for Obama because of what you said, because he's white. Right. So it's harder because of the legacy of the welfare queen, that myth, it's right. going to be harder to associate food stamps, welfare with a white man.
Yeah.
Because it's so ingrained in people's mind that that's a black
ingrained, man. Yes. Mm-hmm. So for my breakdown, for decades, the stereotype of the so-called welfare queen, like you said, has been demonized. And black women, you know, and that's tragic. And to know that it didn't even have anything to do with the black woman. It was a con artist who was multiracial.
Yes.
And was raised as a white woman. And they are encapsulating a bitterness towards black women receiving welfare, the much needed welfare, when they're overlooking the overarching number of white Americans who actually see more public assistance than anyone. And I have to admit, do more of the blue collar crimes than anyone.
Yeah.
You know? So it's just unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. And my breakdown echoes that as well. And, you know, Trump did a real big number on empowering those ignorant poor whites and getting them to buy into policies that are to their detriment. And for that, I have little compassion, but I mean, I don't think poor white people are listening to our podcast, but if
maybe a few.
Maybe a few. I don't know. Maybe they're hate watching. But if you are hate watching, my message is to you is to wake up and recognize that poverty is something that cannot be escaped by the color of your skin. Mm-hmm. And this country will continue to benefit and criminalize you and keep and make you as poor as possible. And have you believing that supporting these rich white men and women into believing that you can one day become them when they're doing everything in their power to make sure that's impossible. Yeah. So it makes no sense to hold on to the racism in your heart because it's just going to keep you further in your hell.
Yeah, true, yeah. True.
Ending the show again, featuring Black women, I found something for our Inspire segment. So this is the part of the show where we bring to you a story that is uplifting and hopefully will leave you smiling.
Yes.
So it's almost the end of May. It's graduation season. And today's Inspire segment is about Vivian Cunningham. She is a great-grandmother of three who earned her undergraduate degree in liberal studies at Alabama's Samford University at 78 years old. She spent 6 years working towards her degree in liberal studies at the university, and she's quoted by saying, "I say follow your dreams. Don't let anyone tell you it can't be done. Keep pushing and keep God in the plan." Hmm. She spent 29 years working as a custodian and then as the head of the mailroom for the Alabama Power Company before retiring in 1992. She then used the company's tuition reimbursement program to earn an associate degree in paralegal studies from Virginia College. But she wanted to continue her education beyond the one degree. So she went ahead and got her undergrad degree, and she graduated this May. She's also motivated her own daughter to pursue her PhD at North Carolina A&T after her daughter earned an undergraduate degree at Averett University and a master's degree at Webster University. Her daughter's son, Vivian's grandson, is mm-hmm. also now in a master's degree program
wow.
at the University of Miami after graduating from Old Dominion University. So, you know, Black women have been the thread through this episode, and mm-hmm. I just wanted to make sure that we inspire by highlighting a Black woman that shows, you know,
it doesn't follow that stereotype. Yeah, exactly. Black girl magic, and doesn't that has broken that stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and what's so amazing, she's inspired two generations after her.
Absolutely, you know? Absolutely, and that she didn't stop. You know, like her life went one way. I'm sure she worked those many years at those jobs to make sure that her daughter and her grandson, you know, had a life that would allow them to pursue higher education in that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the article also mentioned that, you know, she started her undergrad degree in school. She would take night classes and be the oldest person in the class. And then when COVID hit, she had to transition to virtual learning, and her daughter had to help her. So she probably would have been good with that book that we mentioned.
Yeah.
You know, she was like, I don't know much about technology. My daughter had to help me, but she made it through and she graduated.
Wow, I'm really impressed by that, because a lot of times people say I'm too old to go back to college to learn something. She's broken all those mm-hmm. stereotypes.
Mm. Yeah, she said don't give up. She's like, I love learning. So salute to you and congratulations, Vivian.
Yes.
So that's our episode.
Yeah,
we did
another
it.
One in the hopper.
We did it. And so for those of you listening, if you heard at the beginning, DJ said that this is our penultimate episode. We have one more left in season one, so be sure to tune in next week. We're going to make it special. But thank you again so much for continuing to listen, continuing to let us know that you're listening, and engaging with us on social media and supporting us through this season.
Yes. Then thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I'll talk more about it, I guess, next week about the love that we've gotten over our first season. And we've gotten so much love. So, so thank you.
Yeah. If you want to, you know, be a part of the love that we're going to share next week, you can reach out to us on Instagram at Breaking It Down Show, at Facebook, on Facebook mm-hmm. at Breaking It Down Podcast, and you can email us
at breakingitdownshow@gmail.com. Again, that's breakingitdownshow@gmail.com.
Yes. So thank you so much, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Breaking It Down with DJ and Courtney is edited and produced by Designs by Courtney H. Music produced by Courtney Hinton. Thank you for listening.
Please subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review.